This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is The Informer, Australia's only LGBTIQ+ national news and current affairs show. Proudly sponsored by KHQ Lawyers. Passionate about being the best.
And some legislation in the United States has had an extraordinary impact on sex workers here in Australia. The legislation, known as Sesta Foster, was billed as stopping child sex trafficking.
America's Dr. Oz helped put pressure on the U.S. Congress to act.
As you know, the director of the film, I Am Jane Doe, I've got the whole audience in because this is a community effort. I gotta say, your movie is absolutely fabulous, and what it did to me was to open my eyes up to the very real problem of child sex trafficking that is actually happening right here in the United States. What's shocking is that it's happening in plain sight through ads placed on websites like Backpage.com. I say plain sight because law enforcement and victims have been unable to hold them accountable. And what makes this even worse is that some of the biggest companies in America, like Google and Facebook, were helping to fund the defense of Backpage when the legal system tried to stop them. Now, after Mary was on the show last year, she was on the show talking about this. I was so disgusted that I started a petition on change.org with one of the women who was, girls actually, who was on the show who had been sex trafficked to tell the tech industry this was not okay.
TV host Dr. Oz there. Toby Halligan spoke with Dean Lim, a sex worker, about the change.
So, Dean, the United States has passed some laws. They were originally passed in 2018, but they're laws that have quite substantial implications for Australian sex workers too. Can you give us some context on those laws?
And so the laws were Sesta Foster, and they basically initiated from the Trump administration, and it was about looking at child sex trafficking and sex trafficking in general. So the idea behind them was quite a good idea. Unfortunately, the repercussions were that it looked at different websites or affected different websites, and it forced them to close down. And these were major websites called Backpage and also Craigslist. And a lot of sex workers worldwide would advertise through these websites because they're free, and it was a very easy way for clients and sex workers to communicate and do business. Mm-hmm. The reason why it affected Australia is that a lot of sex workers in Australia also use Backpage and Craigslist because they're international websites. And once those laws were affected, it actually meant that these websites closed down. Mm-hmm. So the American administration went hard, and they actually forced Backpage to close, and subsequently Craigslist closed down because they feared prosecution. Mm-hmm. Because of that, it literally shut down these websites overnight. Mm. And so sex workers didn't have another platform to advertise in such a quick way. Over time, there are other websites have appeared, and workers have been able to find ways of communicating with and advertising with clients, and vice versa.
And those laws that were focused on dealing with sex trafficking, is that going to be a problem on these news sites?
No,
is there a sense?
Not at all. Mm. Not at all.
Right. Was that a legitimate concern?
No.
Do you think when they created the law? So was that just a facade for basically?
It was very moralistic. It was. I feel personally that it was a lot of propaganda to show that the Trump administration were doing the right thing, that they cared about children, they cared about people who were sex trafficked, and it was the totally wrong way of doing it. Mm. We can take care of people through legislation, so things like having full decriminalisation of the sex worker industry, that's what we should be aiming for, rather than having really harsh laws to say, well, if your website doesn't adhere to certain rules or regulations, we'll investigate you, we'll shut you down, we'll make you nervous. Mm-hmm. It's a very hard kind of almost like a corporal punishment.
Yeah. Yep.
Way of doing things.
Yeah, absolutely. And why is having access to those online spaces so important for sex workers? Because I know for a whole range of sex workers, it's actually much safer than the other forms of advertising or you know, service provision, if you like.
With business, especially as a sole trader, it gives you a lot of autonomy, a lot of control over where you want to work, and how you want to work. You are your own boss. So being on the internet, social media, all these websites, it put the control back into workers. Once these websites closed down, a lot of workers, or some workers, were affected really negatively.
Mm.
So people, especially in America, we've seen cases of people going back to pimps, going back to brothels, going back to really dangerous situations where they cannot control their workplace environment, or the managers or people that they work with. So that was quite unfortunate. People, you know, lost their rental income. They lost a means to pay rent, bills. And I know of workers in Melbourne who male and female, who were very negatively affected, and they had trouble paying bills.
Mm.
The flip side to that is that it actually mobilized our community, so that we all really rallied together and supported each other and helped each other with bills or housing or whatever we needed. So there was a positive, and there are other things that have occurred. So workers have tried to take control of the situation. I actually spoke with a sex worker by the name of Estelle Lucas, and she set up a hosting platform. She's also set up a website called Red Files, where sex workers can access information, advice to support each other and ask questions. And so things have happened. There's different organizations that have come through this. So for example, I mentioned decriminalization. Another organization that has happened is Sex Work Law Reform Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an organization, and that has been set up to really educate politicians and the public regarding decriminalization. And that's something hopefully we can have in Melbourne, Victoria, which we don't have at the moment.
Yeah. I don't think a lot of people realize that, actually.
Mm.
Like, it's not something that people necessarily think that much about. What is the state of law in Victoria, though?
So we have a legalized model, which means that sex workers have to be registered. They get a number, so it's like an ABN number, but it's just for sex working. And there are very tough rules regarding that. So you cannot work from home. You have to work outside. So you have to visit a client in their home or hotel. The client can't have the booking if it's a hotel. You can't have the booking in your name. It has to be the client's name. So it leads to a lot of, I guess, kind of really tricky issues regarding privacy and control of work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're going for a full decriminalization model.
Mm. Like, this kind of, in a way, feels like it's connected to the quite horrific murder of Michaela Dunn in Sydney. Michaela was a sex worker who was murdered quite horrifically by a gentleman, Mert Nye. And I think that's raised a lot of questions about the ability, exactly what you're talking about safety and also about stigma. Can you tell me, what was your reaction when you saw that story?
I have mixed views on that. I think that a person's workplace or profession shouldn't be the story.
Mm.
And I think that her profession as a sex worker became the story.
Yeah.
And it became so sensationalized that the media didn't look at, well, why did this guy do this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Was it mental health issues? Mm-hmm. Was it, you know, what's going on? What's the real story? Rather than being so sensationalized to say, oh my gosh, this woman is a sex worker. Well, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone should have the right to have safety in their workplace. And she, from what I can what I saw, she did have some safety in that she had another flatmate present.
Mm.
And it was just an unfortunate state of circumstances that led to her death.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, New South Wales has a decriminalised model for sex workers.
Mm-hmm.
So, generally speaking, New South Wales is okay to work in. It's just a very unfortunate situation.
Mm. And it seemed like her humanity, in a way, got, like you say, got sensationalised. Do you think that part of that is because there remains, I beg your pardon, this stigma around sex work in Australia?
Very much so. Mm. Very much so. In Australia, it's slowly changing, but generally speaking, in Australia, there is a whole, I guess, stigma regarding even sex and sexuality.
Mm.
Which feeds into the sex worker industry.
Mm.
And so anything relating to sex is just sensationalized and blown out of proportion.
Mm.
I mean, yeah, she's at the end of the day, she is a person and she deserves the right to be described as a person who had a life.
Yeah.
Versus this is her profession.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. One of the other moving kind of way beyond, you know, as you say, your profession, an ongoing issue is discrimination within the LGBTIQ plus community. Is that something that you've experienced?
Yes and no. I think in terms of being a sex worker, yes, there's been a lot of stigma because it's really interesting, especially being gay and looking at the gay community worldwide, because I've worked overseas and I've travelled a lot, there is a lot of stigma in that if you are a sex worker, gay guys or the gay community kind of shuns you. Mm. Whereas if you give sex away for free, that's okay. You're just being adventurous. You're a stud. Or if you're a porn star, that's slightly different as well, because you're in the entertainment industry, you're like a model.
Mm.
Versus if you are a business person who has sex as your business,
mm-hmm.
that's really frowned upon.
Mm.
And I've encountered that quite a lot.
Yeah, right. And what how do people explain, obviously in some ways understanding, you know, people's internalized prejudices can be challenging. What do you think it is that drives that?
It's quite confronting, because if you give sex away for free, that's a choice, whereas people don't understand that if you do it for business, they can't get their heads around it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that just makes perfect business sense.
Sure.
Why not?
Yeah, absolutely. No, like that's fair enough. Yeah, mm. Yeah. I guess, like you say, there is this sense within being sex positive within the gay male community is seen as just totally normalized, and people really kind of celebrate it. So I do find it interesting. Is there a sense of jealousy, perhaps, do you think? Is that part of it? Like, I don't imagine people would admit that.
It's partly jealousy, and I think it's also very confronting.
Yeah.
Because if you... People can't... I guess if you haven't experienced it, you don't understand. But it's really about having two different roles. Mm. There's your business side, and then there is your personal life.
Mm-hmm.
And the two are very separate. But in general conversations, a lot of the general public don't understand that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's work. Mm. Sex work is work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting that a community that has experienced so much moral opprobrium in different kinds of circumstances seems often at times to have absorbed some of those values. I guess related to that, when you have, I presume you will have had, you know, partners and relationships while you've been a sex worker, obviously. Has that been something that, is it a space that's tricky to negotiate with partners sometimes?
Extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, you know, I wouldn't tell anybody about my work life, my history. And it's very tricky to negotiate because, again, I've come across the stigma and, in some ways, a lot of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Mm. Where, and does that judgment again come from people struggling to understand it? Is it a function of, like, is it possessiveness? Like, I know that female friends of mine who have engaged in sex work, like, it's interesting, actually. One of my closest friends is a gay woman but has male clients. And in a way, I think that has been easier for her to navigate in some ways, because with female partners, there's not that sense of competition. Like, it's odd that we still in 2019, you know, this sense of sex being a function, like the possessiveness that we associate with it. And I guess historically, when women, say, didn't have control of their biology, that might have made a bit more sense. You know, when people couldn't control, you know, if you have sex with people, you're most likely to get pregnant, or STIs. But we do now have, you know, so much, that medical science has advanced so much, but we still seem to have these ingrained values. Like, where do you think that comes from? Is it a function of religiosity? Is it cultural values? Like, yeah, do you find it changes depending on the background of potential partners that you've had?
It's tick the box, all the above. I think it just stems from having a more sex positive mindset. And I feel that with the newer generation, the younger generation of people growing up now, their attitude is much more sex positive in terms of being non-binary. So in terms of being non-binary, more gender fluid, I think that's the way to go versus what we have now, which is a little bit more constrained of, you know, what does a man look like? What does a woman look like? It's kind of very old-fashioned.
Absolutely. Dean, this has been quite a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for...
we could go for hours.
This is the thing, yeah? Like, it really could continue for a very long time. Thank you very much for joining us here on The Informer.
Thanks, pleasure.
We'll be back with more on The Informer. Toby Halligan has been speaking with a sex worker about how a small change in American law has had dramatic impacts on sex workers here.
Can you provide us some context on what those laws are?
Yes, they were laws that were purportedly passed to stop human trafficking in the sex trade. And this is often a sort of Trojan horse, which is used against sex workers. The laws that they passed rolled back part of what's called the Safe Harbors legislation in the United States, which is the legislation that allows you to be fairly free in what you say and publish on internet sites, because the internet service provider is indemnified by not being the direct publisher of the content. It's taken away that distinction for anybody involved in sex work or things to do with sex work. So now, well, I'll tell you what happened. We knew the legislation was coming. We knew civil rights groups in the United States and American sex workers were campaigning vigorously against it. Because not only did they know what effect it was going to have on them and their livelihoods, but they knew that it was actually going to have the opposite effect to the one that was intended around the human rights and sex trafficking that it was supposed to stop. It would actually make that easier if it was occurring. And the legislation passed, and we thought everything would be fairly okay until it was signed into law by the president. And that wasn't going to happen for possibly a couple of months. But the day it passed the last House of Congress, or the last part of the congressional process, we lost our livelihoods. Anybody in around the world, but especially in the United States, but also in countries like Australia here, our ads were pulled almost immediately. It was a weekend, and I was on the internet on Facebook, as you do, and my policy person was on Facebook as well, and maybe I was working, maybe I had a few ads up, I can't remember. But the whole thing came crashing down all of a sudden. The major sites within a couple of hours just absolutely disappeared. So that's like, for you guys, if you turned up to work at the radio station and found the radio station was gone and the door was boarded up and it just said closed, never reopening. That's what happened to us. For American sex workers, that was totally devastating. But we had sex workers here, like we're normal people. We've got mortgages to pay, rent to pay, children's school fees, children's food to buy, dogs to feed, you know, parents to look after, all those normal things. And all of a sudden, there was absolutely no income because our incomes, you know, come in every day. And all of a sudden, it was absolutely cut off. Mm-hmm. So it was quite catastrophic. In the United States, sex workers who had never done what's called outdoor work or street-based work had no income from the internet or indoors. So many of them decided they'd go to the old outdoor strolls, as they're called, and try to work there. Now, if you've never done that sort of work before and you don't know, like, any sort of work, taxi driving, nursing, being a policeman, if you don't know the ins and outs of it and how to keep yourself safe, you're not going to be particularly safe doing something on your own outdoors. And American sex work organisations maintain that 14 sex workers were murdered in the first week of foster sester. Because there are people who are predatory out there, and when they know that there are easy targets, whether they be sex workers or people or women walking home across parks or from bars just to their homes a couple of blocks away, bad things unfortunately happen.
What impact has the loss of business as a result of the lockout laws had in terms of people's practices? Are sex workers having to resort to more dangerous practices, or what's been the overall impact?
Okay, most sex workers, because there's no employment, a lot of people have left the area. That mightn't sound like too dramatic, but, you know, when you have to up stakes and move yourself six or eight suburbs away or further, or some people have gone interstate, that's a bit of a problem. But with street-based work in Sydney, there hasn't been very much street-based work for many years. There have been less than 100 people working in any of the three areas that operate in Sydney. The lockout law has really put an end to the King's Cross street-based sex working areas. People did start to sort of follow the trade later at night and come out later at night. Whether or not that's more dangerous is a matter of opinion. Street-based work, most of the violence that is encountered comes from the general public rather than from clients or other sources. So if there's less general public around, it's actually safer for us. But then again, there are less clients as well, so, you know, swings and roundabouts.
It's complex, isn't it? And has there been an impact on, in particular, LGBTIQ plus sex workers as a result of the lockout laws? I know that the LGBT scene in particular in Sydney has suffered as a result of them.
Well, yeah, the lockout operates down Oxford Street, so that's not particularly good for that area either. King's Cross and the area around William Street has been a traditional street-based area for trans women workers especially, and that's definitely suffered, and a lot of people have joined the rest of us working online rather than working on the street. But with the lockout laws, like, putting the final sort of full stop on that.
We've been speaking about sex work and the impact of the lockout laws and legislation in the United States and some unexpected consequences from that. Here's Toby Halligan continuing his conversation with Cameron Cox.
The cross where the lockout laws mainly operate, but not exclusively, has always been a traditional sex working area. And so there's been street-based sex work at one time and brothel-based sex on premises
sex work, and like any other business, we rely on people coming to the area, and people used to come to the area to party, especially on the weekends, and then they'd wander home, and like any other business, a cafe or whatever, if they wandered past a cafe and felt hungry, they'd buy a cup of coffee. If they wandered past somebody who was working, they might feel another hunger, and that person would make some money as well. But since we've had the lockout, that doesn't happen. And the lockouts have a cumulative effect. Sex workers often live in the same area as they work. Surprise, surprise. Mm. I do. I actually live in King's Cross. You can see the Coca-Cola sign from my place. You could probably throw a rock at it and smash one of the pretty coloured lights. Mm. And, you know, the money goes round and round in the economy. So if I'm not spending money at the local cafe is maybe putting off repainting, which means the local hardware shop's not getting money, which means that, you know, the local schools might maybe not getting that extra donation from the hardware shop. And it really has strangled the economy. I walk sometimes across, and I do my shopping like about 10 o'clock on a Sunday night. And even on a Sunday night, the Cross used to be sort of healthy and happy. Now it's like this deserted, horrible wasteland. Yeah, it's horrible.
And I know that SWAP has experienced or has been hearing increased reports from Australian sex workers that they are experiencing an increased level of violence.
Not, I wouldn't put it that way. In the first couple of weeks, when it became apparent to some people who hire sex workers regularly, or we call them hobbyists, they've got an unusual interest in sex work and sex workers, and often a client, a fairly regular client. Some of those people who you would describe as possibly predatory tried predatory type behaviour. Basically, well, you haven't got any income. How about, you know, you do it for half price? How about you do this? How about you do that? Knowing that the sex worker had all of a sudden experienced an income drop to absolutely zero and was wondering how they were going to, like, pay their bills.
This has also just a fundamental impact on the ability of sex workers to control their work environment, doesn't it? Can you talk us through that?
You have to balance up your safety against, you know, the possible risks against what you may have to do to make money. I'll give you an example that's not close to home and is not foster sester, but it's fairly germane. There's another set of laws called the Nordic model, which is started in Sweden, and it's where very nicely, apparently they criminalise the client, but they decriminalise the sex worker. What actually happens, and they've brought this law in recently in France, is that the clients then are very scared that they're going to get arrested. So especially with street-based work, they won't come anywhere into the light, and they won't stay anywhere very long. And if you want that job, you have to make a split second decision whether you're going to go with that guy or not. And you don't have time to talk to him, establish a rapport, see if there's anybody in the back seat of the car, whatever. I used to be a street-based worker myself. So in Paris, in the Bois de Boulogne, which is a big park where lots of sex goes on, but paid sex as well, the street-based workers who used to work there and work along the well-lit roads are now forced to work right sort of way back in the bushes in the dark where there's no lighting. And within months of that legislation coming in, a sex worker who I met in Amsterdam, Vanessa Campos, was murdered there because people who like to bash trans people, and she was a trans worker, so LGBTQI, knew that the sex workers wouldn't be anywhere near where the police or other people were, that they'd be very much in the isolated, dark areas trying to find clients and easy pickings. So the same thing, foster sister does the same thing, but not in such a physical, like in the park sort of way.
Mm. And what has been the response of sex workers in Australia and around the world to these laws?
Okay, so we fight both of them. We've been fighting the Nordic model for a very long time. As you guys might know, down in Victoria, you have a Greens politician who espoused those laws up until quite recently. And every time that person stood for election, sex workers from all around Australia flew in to campaign against them. With Foster Sesta, however, there's only so much that you can do without support. And quite frankly, nobody really seems to care very much about this law and the fact that it's done a lot of damage to sex workers and a lot of damage to free speech. But there's very little support for the sex worker point of view here in Australia. The tide's turning a little bit in the United States, where law enforcement is now stepping forward and saying this is a bad law because it's made their job more difficult. The job that it was supposed to make easier, it has actually made almost impossible for them. So we're getting support from a sort of unexpected quarter there. But here in Australia, it's people see it as a far-off sort of thing. Oh, yeah, it's a United States law. What does it have to do with me? You'd be surprised the reach of the United States law. If you deal with a company or corporation that's basically got anything to do with the United States, the long arm of US law reaches out and tries to grab you. And the Australian government, it was Malcolm Turnbull when this law came in, Malcolm said that he thought it was a really good idea and could they have reciprocal rights, please?
And that's Cameron Cox, CEO of the Sex Worker Outreach Program in New South Wales, speaking with Toby Halligan. Earlier, we heard from Dean Lim, a sex worker and one of the hosts of Behind Closed Doors, a radio show on 3CR about sex work by sex workers. This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.